Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
What's up? Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. And, of course, our friends at Straight Talk Wireless. Well, they don't play any games. Get the unlimited plan with 25 gigs of high-speed data and 2G for $45 a month, saving you half the cost of big carriers. No contract, no compromise. Savings may vary. See terms and conditions at straighttalk.com. Mama Momo's here on a Ramona Shelburne Wednesday. Hello, Mama Momo. How are you?
Oh, look at that. I'm like a branded day now.
It is
like
branded. It. Yes, it is a branded day. And Stephen A. Smith is going to join us in less than 20 minutes. He had his big ABC to do yesterday, the SportsCenter special on The Last Dance. So we'll talk to him about a number of things, including Shaq dropping some interesting knowledge on Kobe on the show yesterday. So we'll have that in a couple of minutes. So make sure you tune in for that. And then, of course, we can just have fun with Stephen A. I want to ask him, Momo, out of the gate, whether he has more fun doing General Hospital on ABC or having his own SportsCenter special on ABC?
Because I'm curious. 100% General Hospital.
I'm curious to see the answer to that. But I want to start here, Momo. There's basketball stuff to get into, so we'll do that in a few minutes. But I want to start with you on Major League Baseball, because there's something that I've been kind of pounding the table on here recently. Mm-hmm. And it's been this constant theme that I've had, which is read the room, okay? Learn how to read the room. And it's something that you can apply to any walk of life, right? This doesn't have to do with Major League Baseball all the time, but in this particular case, it does. For example, going back to Blake Snell, right? His comments. I am 100% in favor of Major League Baseball players, because of their collective bargaining agreement, negotiating their salaries to the best of their ability. I would like them to do it at the negotiation table, not in public, because that's always a losing proposition, right? Mm-hmm. And Bryce Harper made some similar comments, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, you guys got to learn to read the room. There's 36 million people unemployed. There's 90,000 dead. Like, this thing may not be going away anytime soon. We're going to have to evolve with life. Everyone's making sacrifices. Just read the room. Get your money, but do it at the negotiation table. So people were saying, for the most part, people were agreeing with me, but some people were pushing back. You're anti-labor, George, which is silly. I'm anti-messaging in that case. But Tom Glavine came out yesterday, or actually this morning, and said players are at risk of taking blame if baseball season is called off. And he's stating the exact reasons that I stated, which is the optics look terrible. The owners have set you up to fail here by putting that bait out about the 50-50 split, and here they are taking it. So hopefully, with Tom Glavine saying it, I think that it resonates more than just a bunch of media gas bags. But, I mean, look, you've covered a lot of sports, Momo. You've talked to a lot of players. You've dealt with owners. You've dealt with labor strife. Like, there's no way anyone can convince me otherwise that the optics of this are terrible, and you just should keep quiet in this spot.
Well, I think what is problematic for the players, and I get why they're upset. I agree with you, George. This isn't the right way to negotiate, because you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Like, if you don't take it public, then nobody understands why you're upset, and then you just look like a bunch of greedy guys, you know? If you do take it public, you still look like a bunch of greedy guys, because nobody wants to hear it right now from a bunch of millionaires and billionaires, right? Like, we're just in that position. So I think with baseball right now, they have to have a level of trust, and that's the biggest thing that I've noticed between the NBA and all the other leagues, which is simply the players and owners don't trust each other. They don't have a bridge. They don't have a good relationship between commissioner and players. Adam Silver has gone out of his way. I think if you would mark any part of Adam Silver's tenure, it was like, this is what Adam Silver did, and this is how you define it and characterize it. I think the bridge that he's built with the players directly, where they have his cell phone and call him directly all the time. They trust him. They understand his motives. Like, that is probably the hallmark of his commissionership. And I think what you're seeing, and why players are negotiating and saying things like this out of turn, and it's probably not helpful, is because they just simply don't trust the commissioner and the owners.
Right.
And that's it. And I feel bad for them, because they're going to lose either way. Like, you're going to, if you, with what the owners did is they kind of backed him into a corner. Okay. Mm-hmm. First, they said they were, you know, if you remember, baseball and its owners were the first, was the first league to sort of work out how the money was going to be done this year before they canceled spring training. Like right in and around then is when they worked it out. And they projected it based on 120 game schedule, right? Okay, mm-hmm. Okay, 50-50 sounds like a good split when a 120 game schedule. Well, when baseball owners came back with their proposal, it was for an 80 game schedule.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to be that good at math to know how many less games that is now, right? Like that's like 80 games a lot different than 120 games, right? It's 40 different games. It's a
yeah,
third.
50% less from the 50% less.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a little bit of a bait and switch. Now, I don't know if it was intentional, right? At the time they did 120 games, nobody knew how long this was going to take. Nobody knew when we're going to get back. But I could see why baseball's players might feel this way. I can't.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get that.
But it's also like, you know, what they've now, this is a great negotiating tactic that the owners are pushing, which is, hey, let's work everything else out. Let's work all the health and safety stuff out. Let's work out how we're going to feel comfortable coming back. And then we'll talk about the money. And the money will just be the last impediment to getting a deal done. Well, of course they're going to do that, right? If you do that, then they've backed you into another corner, which is like, well, we're all ready to go. We've worked out all the safety things. We've agreed on everything else. But the players are greedy and they don't want to take less money. I mean, they've totally set them up and negotiated poorly. And negotiated really well to where the players now have almost no choice but to do this. And
Right.
I think that I don't think they can turn it around. And I to be quite frank, I think they need to look at their negotiators, their bargaining, you know, Tony Clark and the Players Association, because like you've already lost. Like however this ends up.
Yeah, you're not gonna get what you want. Right.
They're not gonna get what they want. The owners have already played this chess game way better than the players.
Yeah, and their union is to blame too, because they fell for the trap early. So when is baseball actually coming back? And by the way, Stephen A is gonna join us in 12 minutes. Jeff Passan on Get Up this morning. Here's Jeff Passan, our friend, ESPN MLB insider.
Yeah, this deal needs to be done with May still on the date. Like that, it's as simple as that. If you don't have that, then you will not have baseball in early July, starting off actual regular season games. You will not have spring training. There's so much logistically that needs to get done that this 67-page plan outlines. And whether it's physicians, whether it's teams, whether it's players, you need to have everything running as smoothly as possible if you want to hit those timetables.
Right. And Tim Kirkjian said this morning on the KBO broadcast, the Korean Baseball Organization broadcast, that if they don't get it done by May, as Jeff alluded to, that you're talking about maybe 60 games. So you're looking at even less money for the players. So it is in their best interest, to your point, Ramona, for them to get this done sooner rather than later. And just understand there's going to be losses here and try to mitigate those losses. So,
well, I mean, George, here's what's happening. It's like, the owners made one offer, and then they said, okay, cool, we accepted that. And they came back and made another offer, which is a less good offer, right? And that offer sort of is going to expire probably in the next 10, 12 days, whatever is left in May. And then they're going to come back with another less good offer. So every day that goes by, they're getting a less desirable package.
Correct.
Here. And,
correct.
And absolutely nobody feels bad for them. Like, that's what the problem is. It's like, you've already backed yourself into this corner, and I don't think that they can win this one. I really don't. I think Tom Glavine's right. Like, no matter what happens, they're going to – and if they end up playing, or if they don't end up playing, they're going to get blamed. And I think at some point you have to look at, you know, the hand that you're dealt in a negotiation. And no matter what the negotiation is, like, what are you fighting for? Doesn't that always come to that in any negotiation you're doing, whether it's an – argument with your wife, whether it's negotiating on a car? Like, if you really want that car and the dealer knows that you have no other options, like, you're gonna get that car. He can hold firm on something.
Yeah.
But if you're not gonna, if you could just walk down the street to the next Honda dealership or Tesla dealership or whatever your price range is, right, then he's got to bend. Like, and you got to know it, because if not, you're just gonna walk away and try somebody else and get a better deal. So I think the players, it's going to come down to, do you want to play or not? if you want to make half your salary, take it now. If you want to make 60% of your salary, it might not happen.
Yeah.
Because it's either – it's going to be something like 50%, then 30%, then 25%. Like, it's
going to Yeah, it's just going to keep dwindling for sure. Yeah. So, Ramona, before we get to Stephen A., because I want to get this in here in the second – in the first segment, there's reporting being done by The Athletic – about Disney World being a clear front runner. I know that Woj yesterday on SportsCenter, I saw him saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when with the NBA. We've got about 3 minutes here. So where are we on the NBA right now?
I agree that Disneyland is, Disney World feels like the front runner. And I've been hearing that for several weeks. Like you've always heard the Orlando / Las Vegas ideas, right? Like Western Conference in Las Vegas, Eastern Conference in Orlando. But every time I would bring up the Las Vegas idea to people, and when I say people, I mean executives, coaches, players, people who work for the union, people who work for the league. Everybody would always kind of say, I'm not so sure we want to have players where there's all that gambling around in the Las Vegas lifestyle, that, you know, whatever's going to come back, whether it's nightclubs or casinos or whatever it is. Like, I as much as the league is very comfortable there at Summer League and for the, you know, do they do the G League showcase there now too, right? As much as they're comfortable there, I think there's a bit of a fear about what that would be like, the bubble in Vegas with all the vices and everything else going around in Vegas. Whereas at Disney World, they can be relatively secluded and there won't be quite as many temptations.
Right. Agreed. And look, to be honest, right, you can let guys kind of stay within the campus atmosphere because it's a 40-mile radius, and guys can be like outside their resort if they need to. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's water parks. There's like beaches inside the resort, like man-made beaches. Like, there's things for them to do to kind of clear their mind if they need to get away from basketball for a minute and still be within the confines of where they're at.
Yeah, and I think that's really, I think that's really what the league is pushing, and teams are pushing. Players might be more inclined to go to Las Vegas.
Yeah,
or quite frankly, I think players are more inclined to go to home practice sites. Like that's the other thing that I don't think is off the table yet.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I think that's their bargaining chip.
But here's the thing: here's what they lose if they do home practice sites and they don't do Disney World, Momo.
Huh.
You can't do a drink around the world at your home practice site. You can do that at Epcot Center.
just
word to the wise, anyone who's ever been to Disney World in Orlando at Epcot Center and tries to drink around the world, as someone who's done it a few times, start in Mexico. Don't finish in Mexico. Because it's Mexico's on one end, Canada's on the other. Take the hardcore beer first with Canada.
Okay.
Or excuse me, finish with the hardcore beer in Canada. And start with Mexico, because if you need that to finish with tequila, you're in trouble.
That's a really good point.
That was the first rookie mistake I ever made when I did it the first time.
So you started off with like a Molson, and then you ended up
No. I started with something called Maudit, which is, if you Google it, M-A-U-D-I-T. It's got a devil on the front of the label.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It's like 9% alcohol by volume or something like that, which is pretty strong for beer.
Yeah.
And then we finished in Disney World. This is when I was maybe 21, 22 years old, and I was dating a girl at the time, and we were going to meet some friends to go out that night for dinner and like drinks and dancing and all that. We literally ordered pizza and fell asleep in the hotel room and just woke up the next morning. That's how drunk we were.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds.
So don't do it. Do Mexico first if you ever do it.
Yeah. That's a good tip. Well, what's the line? Beer before liquor.
Liquor before beer, you're in the clear. Beer before liquor, you've never been sicker.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, a bartender told me that that's actually a bunch of crap. But I'll explain later in the show because we got to get to Stephen A.
I need to know that.
Yeah. I'll do that on the other side. Plus, because we've got some time, Stephen A's calling at 10:15 and we only have a 90-second break. So I'll give you the real deal on that. Maybe some bartenders can weigh in on this at 877-710-ESPN. We'll update you on liquor on liquor before beer, you're in the clear, or beer before liquor, you've never been sicker. And of course, Stephen A. coming up in just a few moments. He had an interesting conversation with Shaq about Kobe yesterday. We'll get into that on the other side. We're back in 90 seconds. Mama Momo here. Sedano, 710 ESPN. Sedano with you here. Mama Momo hanging out today on a Wednesday, presented by Progressive Insurance. Listen to their shower sessions, half interview, half concert, all from the shower. Watch new music videos and exclusive interviews at YouTube.com/progressive. Stephen A. Smith will be joining us in just a few moments, giving us the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. No contract, no compromise. So, Mama Momo, we were just talking about liquor before beer. You're in the clear. Beer before liquor, you've never been sicker. So, a bartender told me the order has nothing to do with the severity of like your hangover. And it's basically if you drink a lot, you're going to get sick. Now, maybe people's individual stomachs handle certain things a little different, right? But the fact is it's based on the alcohol consumption and the percentage of alcohol and things of that nature.
So I've heard that one of the biggest reasons why people get either really sick or they get a hangover the next morning is how much sugar is in the alcohol you drink. So like if you're drinking a bunch of fruity drinks or something, like if you're doing a bunch of mixers, it's actually the sugar plus the impurities in the alcohol which give you the hangover, right? Now, I'm not sure how that corresponds to what makes you throw up, but like I think it probably is the same idea, is that if you're drinking pure stuff.
I've actually just looked this up, and this is from a doctor. It says body is actually really good at processing sugar compared to alcohol. So sugar doesn't affect the hangover. It's just that sugary drinks are so much easier to drink because they taste better. So you can lose track of how much alcohol you've had and you push it too far.
Ah, oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, yeah. I'll tell you the only time I've ever drank to the point where I was like super nauseous and throwing up was when my friend at spring training was like, "You need to try an Irish Car Bomb. It tastes like a Snickers bar." And I was like, all right. And I was kind of like in that stage where like, you know, she challenged me. I had to try it. Right. And it was totally good, but it's just so thick. Like, have you ever had an Irish Car Bomb?
Yes. Yeah. Not my cup of tea.
Yeah. I mean, it was so thick. Like I couldn't, it just was like gross. Like to me, the consistency of it, right. With the Guinness and all that. So that's the only time that I've ever gotten to that point. Like if you just drink hard alcohol and don't put a bunch of mixers in it and don't put a bunch of like syrupy sugary you might get faded, but I don't know if you're gonna necessarily throw up.
That's how I do it. If I'm gonna have a drink, I put maybe rocks, splash of water maybe, that's depending on how I feel, but for the most part if I'm gonna have it, I'm going straight. Like give it to me straight, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like you might be able to talk me into like, you know, like ginger ale and something, right? But other than that, like, just get straight to the point. Like, what are we doing here, right?
Yeah. What's the point? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason you're going for this. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, you know, what are we doing here? So a couple of things, Momo, that I wanted to ask you as far as the NBA is concerned. We were just talking about the Disney World situation. And look, I think I have a theory on what they should do, and I'm curious to see how you feel the players would deal with this. Mm-hmm. My thing is this. If you're going to do this campus bubble thing, why not have the last 2 weeks of your training camp, all the teams that are going to participate, because we don't know if it's going to be all the teams, if it's going to be playoff teams, if they're going to do a play-in tournament, whatever. Why not have all the teams that are going to participate arrive 2 weeks early, finish their training camp there. That way they can get tested as much as they need to get tested. Uh-huh. And if they do test positive and have to self-quarantine, individual players or whatnot, you're lessening the impact that they would have to do that during games as opposed to just arriving there and then playing. You know what I'm saying? Like, why wouldn't you at least do 2 weeks of your training camp at the campus atmosphere?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. You know, my thought was, isn't MLS supposed to start up there? Like,
yeah, they're the first one. They're starting now in early June. Yeah.
So they're kind of like the test case, right? Like, let's see how it goes with soccer. Let's see how many players test positive and see what the exposures seem to be in and around the Orlando area. Because like one of the big issues that always comes up when I bring up the idea of the campus bubble is like, well, if you're picking a site that doesn't have a lot of cases right now, but then you're bringing in people from places that do have a lot of cases, you're definitely increasing the risk that you're going to like start a whole chain of new infections in the bubble area, right?
Right.
That's why people are a little bit skeptical about doing home practice sites, or because like you, everybody could just be fine, but there could just be one area. All it takes is just a couple of people in one area where you're, you know, and now it starts to spread and it goes all over the place. Right. So I think that it's, when we talk about the campus bubble, like that, you know, we'll see how it goes with MLS. Like I've been following what's going on.
Ramona, let me interrupt you because Stephen A's on the line. Let's have him jump in here real quick. I've been told Stephen A's on the line. Stephen A. Smith, check out First Take each and every morning at 7 o'clock on ESPN television. Of course, he had his ABC special, SportsCenter special yesterday on The Last Dance. Stephen A., there are a number of things I want to talk to you about that special that I watched last night, but I don't know if you heard what Ramona and I were talking about. My suggestion was, with this campus bubble atmosphere that the NBA is talking about, that my thing is this. Instead of jumping right in there and playing games, whether it's regular season games or playoffs or whatnot, why not do at least the last 2 weeks of every team's training camp in this same bubble environment to mitigate the positive tests affecting games? So if you get there 2 weeks before the games start to finish your training camp, if guys test positive, there's less of a chance of them actually missing real games. What do you make of that?
I don't have a problem with that. I think that's certainly reasonable. I think that right now people are game started and they're thinking about what they can make money off of because of the amount of money lost already. If you're having training camp, guys are getting back to work and you understand that. But if you're having training camp or training camp type atmosphere and the actual games are not being played, that's not going to generate revenue for you. And when you've lost hundreds of millions of dollars, when the sports industry has lost in excess of $12 billion, regardless of how unpopular it is, the people to know that, although they won't engage in verbalizing that mentality, it's all about the money right now. It's all about restarting the economy and stirring up your economic situation so you can address some of the things that you need to address so you can stop losing all the money that you've been losing. That's really what their priorities lie. And that's the only thing that makes any sense as it pertains to being averse to what you suggested.
Stephen, you know, one of the questions I keep having when I talk to people is how much are players aware and how much do they care how much the owners are losing? Right. How much the leagues are losing, because like right now, the first paycheck where players kind of took a haircut was this last one here. It was a 25% pay cut. You know, people us at ESPN had to do that. Like we all had to make our own, you know, our own peace with all that or our own feeling about all that.
Mm-hmm.
They always say when it starts coming out of your pocket, that's when you feel it. Right. When it's coming out of somebody else's pocket, you might feel bad for them. But when it comes out of your pocket, you might feel it. How much do players either feel it themselves or care about what's going on in the league and what's coming out of the owner's pockets?
Well, first of all, make no mistake, the players feel their 25% loss, those that have suffered it. Some guys were paid their salaries in totality up front, so they're not going to take a hit until training camp opens and their new salary for the 2020-21 season kicks in. But you know, for the most part, you got a lot of players out there. They're going to feel that pinch, make no mistake about it. Do they care about the owners losing money? Hell no, they don't. Their mentality is that, number one, they're billionaires. Number two, they're white. Number three, they never really think about us. So why the hell should we think about them? They're not going to verbalize that, obviously, because it's counterproductive to what they're trying to accomplish and establish for themselves. But make no mistake about it, that's how they feel. In the end, here's what it comes down to. The smart ones, the ones that really, really, and that's not to say anybody's dumb, but the real smart ones in terms of the ones who pay attention to both sides, the Chris Pauls, the LeBron James of the world, and various others, they're going to pay attention to the owners because they know there's another collective bargaining negotiation coming up next year. And as a result of that reality, whatever pinch the owners feel, the owners have a way of making sure you feel a pinch too. If not now, definitely later. And that's why Jared Dudley came out with the tweet that he came out with approximately 2 weeks ago or so, when he sat up there and said, open our eyes, people. We don't get back to work, the owners lose that much more money. They lose that much more money. What do you think they're going to do once CBA negotiations open up for us again? They're definitely going to make sure that they address it, and they're going to get something back because, you know, they took such losses now. That's the kind of mentality the smart guys have, and as a result, that also assists in the level of urgency that they have towards playing. They want to play, of course. They miss playing. They miss competing. But in reality, they also know that the more of a pinch these owners feel now, they're going to make sure those players feel it later.
Mm. Stephen A. Smith joining us here. Stephen A., as far as that's concerned, do you believe, though, that we will have radical changes to what the salary structure looks like, whether it's no luxury tax, perhaps, whether it's, you know, an amnesty situation? I know that was thrown out there this weekend as well, about where you could amnesty guys, because that way you could create room within the salary cap to add guys. It could also put players like Blake Griffin, hell, maybe even Chris Paul, potentially on the free agent market, which wouldn't have been the case heading into next offseason anyway. Like, what are some of the things that you would like to see heading into the following offseason?
Well, first of all, I think the biggest thing that, listen, nobody has a definitive answer to that question. What I will tell you is that, you know, when you talk about drastic changes or anything like that, it's all contingent on the amount of losses the owners have suffered from. Mm-hmm. And not only that, what they're projecting the losses will continue to be, because just because they get to come back doesn't mean they're still suffering from losses. You have to remember that we're anticipating they're going to come and have to play without fans in attendance. There's a certain amount of loss that they're going to have to stomach because of that. I've had a couple of owners tell me, excuse me, if we can't have fans in attendance, we might as well relocate, because we simply can't afford the upkeep. We can't afford what we're going to have to deal with without being able to rely upon fan support and fan participation, because it's that pivotal to our financial success. I would tell you, in terms of drastic changes, I think the one drastic thing, and I'm just speculating here, but I think the one drastic change that we will see is when the season actually starts. I do not believe that the season will start in mid to late October. I think that the next season that we have, the 2020-21 season, I think that's going to start in December, and it's going to go into August. That's what I believe is going to happen as of next season. That's just me being speculative based on the amount of people. I mean, Ramona speaks to everybody, and I'm sure she's heard the same thing. But you got a lot of people that are strongly, strongly entertaining that notion, which was first broached by the owner for the Atlanta Hawks long before coronavirus pandemic ever took hold. So I'm looking at that as a strong possibility, but that's the only thing that's drastic. Outside of that, I think they'll look at the books, and they'll determine what kind of losses they have suffered from. They'll project what kind of losses they'll continue to suffer from. And based off of that, they'll try to make their case to the Players Association. This is what it's costing us, so this is what it needs to cost you. And that's where the negotiations will come into play.
Mm. Oh, man, 2020. Let's go back to 1998. You want to do that? Because I've been having fun living in 98. Like, I feel like I peek my head out into 2020, and then I'm like, wait. Maybe I could just go back to 98 for a little while. And right. Like your SportsCenter special last night, that was just, it was perfect, right? Like, can we do another one? I don't know, next week or something, and just like extend this along.
I doubt it.
I mean, why not? I know you worked hard to book all those guests to do all this show. Like this thing, it's amazing to me how many people. How long this news cycle has gone on The Last Dance, right? Like yesterday you had Shaq saying stuff. You had Horace Grant beefing with Michael Jordan. Like he's still upset about everything. Like it's going to continue. Like, you know, they always say don't make a second day story. We're making like a 5-week story. It's amazing.
Well, listen, we love revisiting it because in fairness to ESPN, Netflix, Michael Jordan and everybody in between, the 10-part series wasn't about the 1997-98 season. It was about the Jordan era. Let's just call it what it is.
Uh-huh.
We saw stuff from early in his career. We saw stuff from the late 80s. We saw, you know, the runs in the 90s, the first three-peat, and then the second three-peat. And we got nuggets of stuff from all of those years. And so as a result of that, it allowed us to engage in revisionist history and to see and to fantasize about what might have been, to contemplate what will be in terms of today's generation and how comparable it'll be to the previous generation. All of that other stuff comes into play. But you know what? In the end, if we're being true and real to ourselves, as great as this has been, as many viewers as this has had, and I told Michael Jordan this because he and I spoke often about this stuff. I said, look, man, you wouldn't have this kind of audience if there was basketball being played right now. Mm-hmm. We'd be talking about playoff basketball. Sure, we'd watch it. You'd have a few million people watching it. No doubt about that. But it would not have been, it would not have resonated to the degree that it has. It, Michael Jordan, he's provided us with sports at a time we desperately needed because we're desperately lacking in it. Right now, the two biggest heroes in the sports world is Michael Jordan and Dana White. Because of what they gave us with UFC 249. We could slice it any way we want to, but that's what it comes down to. Because when you're starving for anything, a cracker will smell like steak. It'll taste like steak to you. That's just the way that it is, and that's what we're dealing with right now.
Stephen A. Smith hanging out with us here. Yeah, it's like the Eddie Murphy joke in Raw where he says, what is that cracker? Is that a Ritz? It could be a saltine, but it tastes like a Ritz that day.
That's correct.
Yeah. Stephen A., so let me ask you this. Do you buy into the theory that Michael Jordan greenlit this project? It so happened to coincide shortly after LeBron one in Cleveland. Do you believe that that influenced him, that there could have been an actual threat to the throne?
No, not to me. You know, in talking with MJ, you know, what his attitude was, they came to him and they made a presentation to him that he'd finally have an opportunity to say whatever the hell he wanted to say, unedited or edited to his liking or whatever the case may be. He would say what he felt and it was it, and that was that. And so he saw that as an opportunity to do it, and that's what he did. Obviously, he didn't discuss everything. He clearly ruffled a few feathers along the way. But in his mind, you asked him his honest opinion about something, and he gave it to you. And he was willing to give it to you because there was going to be an extensive amount of time and money dedicated to him doing just that. You know, when you have folks that have been talking about he's made so much money off of this, he's donated it all to charity. He hasn't taken a dime. He's not getting a dime from this. He did it because he wanted to do it because the presentation that was presented to him said, your voice is going to be profoundly heard in this docuseries. Go ahead and speak your piece. And that's what he did.
You know, I think it was interesting because I talked to the producer, Mike Tolan, who made the pitch to Jordan, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a couple of things that I think that get lost in the characterization of, oh, he had the pitch on the same day that LeBron and the Cavs had their victory parade. That was a coincidence, okay? Like, and it was the same year, by the way, the Warriors broke the Bulls record, okay, of 73. They got 73 wins that year. But nobody had ever even gotten into a room with Jordan to pitch him because Michael has Esty Portnoy and Curtis Polk around him, and they are the consiglieres, right? Like, you have to, I don't want to just call them gatekeepers because they're bigger than that, okay? But
no question.
Esty and Curtis had been working on this project for years, and nothing ever made sense to them because Esty and Curtis are the cultivators of brand Jordan, where it's as much about the brand as it is about the man now. And my understanding is they never felt like a two-hour doc or whatever documentaries, you know, were at the time was sufficient to like do justice to the man and his career and the era, as you put it earlier, right? So I know Kobe actually had a meeting with him. Like he wanted to produce The Last Dance. He knew about the footage. There, Spike Lee had a couple meetings over the years, but it never really turned until we started having these limited series, these 8-10 episode series where now Esty and Curtis were saying, oh, okay, maybe out over 8 or 10 episodes, we could do justice to it. And so Mike Tolan, the guy who had this meeting, he's the first guy who ever made it past Esty and Curtis into the room with Michael. And I think that's probably the biggest answer to it all. And the one thing I'm wondering now, though, since you're in touch with Mike, how is he taking the backlash that's coming? How is he taking the Horace Grants of the world, Scotty, whoever else has been ruffled?
It's pissing him off.
Huh.
Because because he knows how much he didn't say in terms of what they have had to say. Like when Scotty, when it became public that Scotty was not happy, he was upset because he says Scotty saw the docuseries before it came out and had no problem with it. So he only had a problem with it after, you know, folks reacted the way that they reacted. I don't know how much truth there is to that. I did not ask Scotty that question. Scotty definitely feels it's the Jordan era. It's a documentary on the Jordan era as opposed to the 1997-98 team. He's quick to remind everybody that Jordan did not win alone, that Jordan won with teammates. Jordan's comeback is, when did I fail to give Scotty praise? I said I could not have won without him. I called him one of the greatest players to have ever played, the greatest teammate that I've ever had. I've said that repeatedly over the years. What's the problem? With the Horace Grant situation, we know what Horace Grant recently said of the last 24 hours. Jordan acknowledges that, listen, the relationship with him and Horace wasn't great. Part of the problem was in 1992, him and Scotty won gold medal for the original Dream Team. After that summer was over and they came into camp, Phil Jackson was accustomed to having two-a-days. He allowed Scotty and Michael Jordan to have only one-a-days because they had played in the summer. And Horace had a fit about that because he felt like they were being treated differently and they were being, you know, there was a double standard. And Michael was like, but we played over the summer. You didn't. So what's the problem? You know, it was stuff like that that got him his nerves. Or Craig Hodges. Craig Hodges is obviously a very Afrocentric. I love him personally in terms of, I don't know him, but as a black man, the challenges that he was willing to take, his intellect, his consciousness, I'm a fan of Craig Hodges. Make no mistake about it. But, you know, to go up to Michael Jordan reportedly and Magic Johnson on the basketball court, before game one of the NBA Finals and ask them to boycott that particular moment to bring awareness to the plight of black America. Could you imagine how disastrous that would have been if Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson would have done that at that particular moment? No plan, no anything. Just, oh, we're not going to play. You know, right before tip-off time. That's what he supposedly wanted to do. So if you're Michael Jordan, you're looking at the people who have had issues with you. You're also witnessing some of their struggles and how they might have a problem with the fact that you haven't had those struggles. I don't know whether what's true or what isn't. I do know to some degree that's how MJ is feeling right now based on their reaction, you know, to the documentary. And he was specifically perturbed. He was specifically perturbed that Horace brought up the word snitch and was talking about Michael mentioning drugs in a hotel room in the early 80s. And Michael Jordan's position is the league was a drug-infested league when David Stern took it over. Everybody and their mother knew that. I didn't mention any names, but anybody that covered the league knew what was going on. So how is it that me saying something like that that's been well-documented and well-publicized about what the state of the NBA was and what it had to become and what it had to turn into – how am I being called that when I mentioned no names? I didn't call anybody out. I simply gave a picture of the kind of climate that I walked into coming out of college. It's like, you know, so he says stuff like this, and that's the kind of stuff that's really ticked him off because he feels like it's unnecessary for people to try to reach. You know, if you want to address him on what he said and say specifically what your problem is, as opposed to trying to reach and attach something to it that he didn't say. That's where he's coming from with it. I understand it, but I also understand Horace Grant being a bit pissed off because if somebody sat up there and said to any of us, you directly leaked information to a reporter about what was going on in our locker room, and any of us believed that we were completely innocent of such an allegation, we would be breathing hell and fury just like Horace Grant is. So I see both sides in that regard.
Stephen A., two more quick ones on the way out here. And Stephen A., make sure you check out First Take each and every morning at 7 a.m. on ESPN television. Thank you so much for giving us the time that you have here. So Shaq yesterday on your SportsCenter special on ABC was talking to you about the impact of Michael Jordan and was talking to you about LeBron and specifically Kobe. And he made the comment that he feels that Kobe should also be put in that conversation with LeBron, with Michael Jordan. How do you feel about Shaq's comments?
I don't have any problem with that. I think Kobe's one of the greatest ever. I think the problem with the Kobe stature or the Kobe cachet is that he's the perennial number two, not as in sidekick, but the perennial number two to Michael Jordan. If it were not for Michael Jordan, we would be having an open discussion every day as to whether or not Kobe Bryant was the greatest off guard in the history of basketball. The problem is that the person that comes before him is recognized as arguably the greatest that we have ever seen in the history of basketball, period, meaning at any position. Michael Jordan is the greatest player in the history of basketball in a lot of our eyes, and he played the same position as Kobe Bryant. So Kobe being number two to that guy, that's really the issue. If there were no Jordan, then we would be having a different discussion about Kobe Bryant. So his greatness cannot be denied. He was honored posthumously as well as he should be and will continue to be for years and years to come because he deserved it. He was a champion. He was a warrior. And my personal, you know, from my vantage point, he was also a friend. I love him and I miss him. And the bottom line is that for him, you know, to be recognized that way by Shaq, I think it's apropos. I think it definitely makes sense. It's just that, again, LeBron James is in the discussion as the greatest ever. Not in my mind, but 14% of the folks in the polls think that he's the greatest ever. He's clearly the greatest small forward in the history of basketball. He's certainly one of the greatest all-around players and arguably on the Mount Rushmore of basketball. So you wouldn't put Kobe there because MJ's already there. That's the problem.
Last one for you, Stephen A., and I think this may be the toughest question we will ask you today. What is a bigger thrill for you, Stephen A. Smith, having your own ABC SportsCenter special about The Last Dance and that great documentary, or being Brick, the fictional character, the recurring role on ABC's soap opera, General Hospital, one of the greatest soap operas in the history of soap operas? Which is it, Stephen A.?
If it were just the show itself, I would say Brick, because I get tickled to death every time I'm on the set with those folks at General Hospital who are absolutely wonderful to me. They're like family, especially the star Maurice Bernard, who plays Sonny Corinthos. That's my man. We talk every week. You know, it's phenomenal for me to be on that show. I absolutely love it, and I'm no actor, but I just love it. I get tickled to death every time I show up there. The only reason that I wouldn't put it above last night's show is because I didn't just host it. It was the first time that I executive produced one of my shows. So I was the executive producer of that last night. And that was the first time in my career that I had ever been allowed to do that. It's something that I wanted to do for a long time. It's something that I plan on doing in the future, starting my own production company that's already in the works and doing some things. I have all of those goals, those aspirations for myself. And ABC, ESPN, they gave me an opportunity to do that last night. And that was my first foray into being an executive producer. So I would have to put that above General Hospital, but only because I was the EP and not just the host.
Well, congratulations, sir. You know, we love you around here. We always appreciate the time. We root for your success. We're very happy for you. And thank you so much again for hanging out with us, man. Stay safe and healthy, okay?
Love you guys. You know, I love you, Ramona. Thank y'all so much. Y'all
take it easy. Thanks, Stephen A. And by the way, I don't want to sell you short, man. You may not have an executive producer title on every show that you do, but I know how hard you work to produce every show you're on.
Hardest working man in sports.
All those guests don't just turn up.
First Take, I don't have the EP title on First Take, but you're absolutely right. My fingerprints are all over that show every day. So you're right about that.
All right, Stephen A., thanks again. Appreciate it. Talk soon.
Y'all take care.
All right, there he is, Stephen A. Smith. All right, we got a lot to unpack there. Plus, Doc Rivers almost quit Find out why in 3 minutes. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN. Thanks to Stephen A. for giving us the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. No contract, no compromise. It's all presented by Progressive Insurance. And if you missed any one of our interviews, including Stephen A. or any of our conversation here with Mama Momo and I, check out the entire interview on demand section on the Sedano Show podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever you find your podcast, brought to you by Eno, the Capital One assistant that catches things that might look wrong with your credit card, sends an alert to your phone, and helps fix them. What's in your wallet? See CapitalOne.com for details. And don't forget to tune in to the ESPN Daily Podcast with our friend Mina Kimes, bringing you a deep dive into a single story of one of ESPN's hundreds of reporters presented by Marathon. Download, subscribe, and review the ESPN Daily with our friend Mina Kimes, available wherever you enjoy your podcast. Sorry, I lost my line of thought there.
No, you know what it is, though? It's because you are so good at the reads. Anytime that you even have like one word that's not perfect, like you're like, whoa, what happened? Like,
I'm also good at speed reading too.
Yeah, you're really good at reads. Like, I'm like, wow, George is like so money every time he reads. And like, you give me some copy. I mean, Greg, every time you give me the live read that I have to do, it's just like, oh, how's this going to go?
More times than not, I can do it. But yeah, sometimes when there's three reads, because we had to combine a bunch of reads here because we went long with Stephen A., which was great, which is necessary, and it's fine. But yeah, every once in a while you get, I skip past the word, or my eyesight goes past the next line. That usually is what happens.
The ones that I have trouble on are the ones where I'm supposed to like ad lib, because I just straight up Anchorman style. I just like read it. And then.
It'll I much prefer that. Yeah, I'd rather just go ad lib.
Some job that you might want somebody to do, and it's like ZipRecruiter. I'm like, dude, just tell me what to say. I don't want to think right now.
Yeah, ZipRecruiter. Just give me what I need to say. Hey, so speaking of some stuff that we were talking about, we're just talking about the NBA. We're just talking about controversy, right? So Doc Rivers was on that Ernie Johnson Twitter cast, basically, and was talking about something that you're intimately familiar with from the Sterling Affairs and your 30 for 30 podcast, which people should still download, subscribe.
By the way,
if you get a chance.
Thank you for shouting it out on the web. I think I won because of your tweets.
I mean, I don't know if you won because of my tweets. You won because it's awesome. But if we could help in any way, shape, or form, because we're friends, that's the whole point.
But
congratulations.
Like, get out the vote. You were get out the vote, George.
We did. And I know other people at the company then retweeted that. And it was, we got some momentum, hopefully, for you. And it worked. So I'm glad you won. Congratulations. What was your five-word speech or whatever?
So I copped out. I just used my son, who's cute, as a prop, kind of.
Right.
Right.
Oh, I saw that. The video. Yeah. Yes, this. Yes,
yeah, because I was going to say, like, you know, in the Sterling Affairs, one of the riffs we do is like how nobody ever uses the word fabulous as much as Shelley and Donald. And like, you kind of did like a cut of all the times I say fabulous. Right. So I was going to say, this is fabulous. Thank you. Right. That's five words.
Okay? Right.
This is fabulous. Thank you. But then I was like, I tried it once. And I just felt like so lame, right? I was like, I can't do it. I'm going to lose my nerve. Because I don't know if people read it or saw it or listened to it or whatever. And they don't know what I'm talking about. And I just look like an idiot saying that, right? So then I was like, you know what? We're going to take a video on the walk with Daniel. And by the way, we only had like a couple hours to do it. Because you find that you win in the morning and you have to send it in by noon, right? So it was like, here comes your speech. So I basically just thought I would have Daniel accept the award for me by blowing kisses, which is what he's good at. So I said, can you blow kisses, right? And then he blew a kiss, and then I just said thanks.
Right, that's cute. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
Not so cute. Not hard transition. Sorry. Yeah.
<It's okay.
laughs> There wasn't anywhere to go there. Not so cute, Donald Sterling. Okay, so
definitely not so cute.
Yeah, not so cute, Donald Sterling. Yeah. So he, Doc Rivers was on the Ernie Johnson Twitter cast recently and was telling a story, again, that I would imagine you were intimately familiar with, mm-hmm. which was that when Doc took the job, he wanted to sign J.J. Redick. And Donald, apparently, according to Doc, didn't like white players. So clearly, Donald Sterling just didn't like anybody. So he threatened to quit. Like, he quit because JJ's agent was calling. Everybody was calling him. And he's like, Donald, I can't have this. And eventually, Donald relented. But what do you remember about that part of it? You know what I'm saying? Just like how strange Donald Sterling was when it came to the JJ Redick thing.
This was one of these stories that, you know, we I had heard about for years, kind of floating around the NBA, and it was like you almost couldn't believe it. You were like, wait, what? He didn't want J.J. Redick because he found out he was white? Like, what? Right? And I think there was a couple parts to it. It was because he was white, and then I also think he didn't like trading away Eric Bledsoe, and Eric Bledsoe was black. Okay, there's the other side of it, okay? And it was but I don't think I realized until we were reporting out for the pod how close Doc was to quitting. And he actually kind of did, in a way. But nobody had ever really stood up to Donald. Like, Donald did stuff like this all the time. I mean, I remember Vinny Del Negro, who was the coach, and he kind of had I guess he was a general manager too. Didn't he have that title at one point?
I don't remember.
Yeah. He had Donald's ear, at least. And he said, you know, they used to, like, come up with potential trades for him to approve, like, in advance. Like, hey, we're talking to this team about, you know, X, Y, and Z, right? Would you do this? And he would, like, purposely, like, misrepresent, like, the what the actual trade might be so that Donald would feel like he negotiated it to a better place. And then he had, like, pre-approval, right? So he would say, like, you know, we want these three players and we'll give up those three players. And Donald was like, no. And then he would approve a deal for, like, 2 and 2 or whatever it was, right? So then Vinny knew he could play with those two players. He kind of had pre-approval because Donald almost – he basically said no to whatever deal it was because he was a – you know, Donald was a litigation attorney. He was a personal injury attorney. You never take the first offer, right? And so I think that he always just thought there was a better deal to be had. But it's just not good business. And I thought the story that Doc shared, you know, was some of that, which is that Donald always says no. He always says no on the first ask, right? Because he thinks he can – now that you've already said yes and you're committed, the other side, he thinks you're going to be – well, you'll give him a little better deal because, you know, things have already been put in motion, right? So now he has the leverage of like, oh, just one last ask, right? So that's partly what Donald would always do. But the other side of it was Donald thought black players were better than white players, which is sort of like – which is racist, definitely, but also like almost reverse racist.
Right. Like, it was just like he's a human conundrum, that Donald Sterling.
So
a human paradox.
The most amazing part of the story, though, that Doc was saying was,
but he's not wrong. I mean, historically, that has been the case. But coming out of his mouth, it's awful. It's weird. Yes, it's strange.
And what he says to Doc is Doc says, listen, I have a reputation in this league. We already have a deal with J.J. Redick. I talked him out of taking a deal with the Timberwolves, and he's, you know, now he's on an island. Like, if we pull back from this, you're going to leave JJ cold and dry. You don't do that. You don't like make a deal.
Right. Well, you ruined the deal with the player. You ruined the deal with the agents. You know, I would imagine every player, black, white, you know, European, it wouldn't matter. They'd all be furious about that.
Yeah, that's partially why the DeAndre Jordan thing was so tough for the Mavericks a couple years later, right?
Right.
That's partially why the Spurs are still upset about the Marcus Morris thing, right? Yeah. You know, they when you think you have a deal with somebody, it locks you into it. It changes your options with other things, right? So Doc says, I have a reputation in this league, Donald. I can't do this. This is going to ruin my reputation. And then Donald somehow says, I have a great reputation in this league. You don't have a reputation. I have a reputation.
I almost cursed. Like, I literally almost said, get the bleep out of here.
I think that's probably what Doc said to him.
Yeah.
Okay, but like, and Doc is like, Donald, I'm the one with a good reputation. You're the one with a terrible reputation. But what it showed was this, like, astonishing lack of self-awareness. Like, you really think you have a good reputation in this league? Like, who is it that's making you feel that way? Was it the cover of Sports Illustrated that said you are the worst owner ever?
Right.
I mean, yeah. Where do you get that from? And I just think that with Doc, like, he kind of put his foot down, and Donald eventually
relented. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure Andy Roser had a lot to do with that.
Good. Well, I mean, just there's always a story with that dude. Good Lord. Good riddance. I've got some other owner stuff I want to get to in a little bit, but I do want to get to some LeBron stuff here. And I know this is going to sound crazy, but I'm going to ask you this, Ramona. Is LeBron underappreciated? We'll get to that. We're back in less than 2 minutes. Don't go anywhere. Stick around. Sedano hanging out with you. Momo hanging out with you. 710 ESPN.